Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome back to the Vibrant Health Solutions Radio Show. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo and I'm your host, and each week I'm always excited to bring you cutting-edge information to help you to be as vibrantly healthy and joyful as possible. And guests are one of the things I absolutely love bringing on. I love to bring in people who have really great thought processes and great cutting-edge research that can really, you can put things into effect right away and can change how you're living your life. This show, we have a very, very special guest, and she's somebody that I got introduced to very early on in my days of practice. Her name is Donna Gates, and Donna is a internationally recognized best-selling author. She's the author of a book called The Body Ecology Diet, which I discovered back in the 90s, and I was thrilled with her approach. And the Body Ecology Diet approaches things related to the gut and microbiome and candida and all those things that have now become popular words, but back then was like first of its kind. She's also the author of a book called The Guide to Growing Younger. Donna was way before her time, as I said. She's just cutting edge all the time. Before it was even popular to go on a gluten-free diet, that's what Donna was telling people about in her book. Before we were talking about glycemic index and low-sugar diets, that's what she was talking about. And what I really loved personally about the book is its balance. She always took this 80-20 approach to it and combined things like Chinese medicine principles and vegetarian versus not vegetarian. Very amazing approach. So I really have loved that. And I'm just so excited and honored to have Donna here to talk to us today. And the name of our show today is The Gut Smart, Gene Smart Diet. And again, Donna being ahead of her time, the Nutrigenomics Project, the project of looking at our genes, we really only started in the 1990s. And now we've identified these millions of different genes that affect how we operate. And now we're really looking at how does this work in terms of our diet and lifestyle and the choices we make. So Donna and I are going to explore this and really help you to see that your genes are not a life sentence. Your genes are not like, hey, I'm prone to get this disease and that's it. That we actually can change the genetic expression, what's called the epigenetic expression, and we can do that via the foods that we put into our mouth and our gut health. And I'm just so excited to be able to explore this with you today, Donna. Thank you and welcome.
Oh, I'm very excited too, because this is a topic that you know a lot about. And this is going to be a fun conversation, and I think for a lot of people, it's the very first time they've ever heard this information.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I would like to hear a little bit about how you got connected with looking at the genes, right? You've been looking at the microflora, you've been looking at the whole ecology, the inner ecology of the body and the gut, but how did you get interested in actually looking at the genetic things that are going on?
Well, you know, I've been teaching such a long time, and I felt like I've been teaching about the inner ecosystem years ago. I coined that term. Now I felt like, wow, everybody's got this. They're focused on the gut. They understand how important it is, and you know, they get that they have to be in a sugar-free, gluten-free diet to get rid of their candidiasis. And there's a lot of people out there, you know, with their websites telling you how to get well, but they're using the right information. And I kind of looked and I thought, you know, well, I'm almost 70, so I thought, well, maybe this, you know, I'm meant to retire now. And then I thought, no, that doesn't feel right. But I didn't know what to do next. So I got real quiet and still, and I put this message out there to the universe. And I said, please, you know, what can I do next that's valuable to people? And this began to fold in, you know how things work when you ask questions like that.
Right.
It started to come in to me, and I got really excited because I began to understand a lot of how very important it is for people to be able to understand this piece of nutritional genomics, matching their genes, which is, they're very unique. There's no one on the planet like them. We can test today very easily, find out what genes there are certain key genes you want to look at, and then we can make adjustments to your diet, to your exercise, lifestyle, sleep habits, and so on, based on what your genes are saying. And then also another thing that began to be understood for the first time ever was that the microbiota in the gut, they have their genes, and there's trillions of them. So just imagine if every single one of them has their own little set of their entire set of genes in their little, you know, microbiotic body, and then we have about 23,000 genes in every single cell in our body. That, oh my gosh, this is a big story here. People have to know this, and I like to take science and make it simple science and get people excited about it, especially if it's going to change their life tremendously like this does. I match them together. I now talk about the microbiome and fixing the gut, you know, as we both totally agree. I mean, I love how in alignment we are, we agree with our messages and our belief system, and that's what you want to find are people like you teaching exactly the same thing so that we can end this crazy confusion out in the world, because people are so confused, they don't know what to do.
They don't know what to do. Yep. They don't know what to do. And it's confusing because there's so many people proposing different diets, like what's the right diet, the paleo diet, the raw diet, the high-fat diet, the low-fat diet, the vegan diet. And people are going, well, if I follow the rules from all these diets, there's nothing left on my plate. How do I do this?
And then they do paleo for a little while, and they think, oh, I feel great. And then all of a sudden they don't feel great because it's not really working. And what I see is very big concern for me, actually, is that some of the diets are promoting a lot of fat right now, butter, cream, lard. And, you know, I'm not saying that those are bad. I mean, a little butter. But looking at the genes, there's a whole lot of people that absolutely can't take saturated fat. So we have to change the story, or people are going to be, you know, continuing to gain weight and have heart problems and be depressed. And there's all kinds of problems that go on. There's a bunch of genes you look at that tell you what kind of fats you need to be eating and what a difference it makes when you eat what your body needs.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's what I love to teach people. And there's so many things that go into what your body needs. The genes are a huge part of it. But then there's also the early exposures, there's the attitudes, the thoughts that change and actually shift our approaches, you know, having adrenal stress, having a thyroid that's out of balance. But it's more than just the genes, but if you don't look at the genes, you may be doing all the quote-unquote right things and not getting the results. And when you do some simple taperings, and there's a lot of examples we can both probably throw in here, when you do some subtle shifts in the percentage of carbohydrate versus fat versus protein, for example, or avoiding certain food groups that maybe the genes aren't able to handle, that phenomenal changes happen.
Yes, and I found this picture. It's a picture of a dragon. So, you know, dragons are obviously mythical.
Yes.
But there's a little girl, and she's holding on to her dragon so tight, and she just loves her dragon. And I love that picture because it says so clearly how we become with our diets. Like, we get in the paleo diet and we think everybody should drop the carbs and just eat paleo. No carbs. Carbs are bad for you. And by the way, we should be eating how our ancestors ate, because they had different, our genes haven't changed in the last thousands of years, but that isn't true.
That's not.
10,000 years ago, our genes changed to adapted, you know, that's what they do. They adapt to their environment. So when we decided that it was maybe a hard life walking around hoping we could find food, and what if we didn't, you know, we decided, hey, let's stop and, you know, gather some animals and grow our food. This could be an easier life. You know, we were getting more intelligent. And then, so it's not a bad thing that we got into agriculture, as some people would have us believe. It was a good thing. And then what happened was our genes adapted in about two generations. They completely adapted to eating different kinds of foods. And then, of course, you know, that was it. And that was, and then very interestingly, the dogs who became our best friends around that time, their genes adapted too, because they were eating like us. So I just want people to know, genes do adapt. Right now, they're adapting like crazy because we're feeding them the weirdest thing we probably ever put into the human body. We are changing them right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that it can happen quickly. It doesn't have to be, you know, centuries where that it takes the genes to shift. It can shift from one generation to the other. And it's not, people say, well, you can't change your DNA. No, you can't change your DNA. You can change the expression. You can change which genes get turned on and which genes get turned off. And there's a lot of diet and lifestyle factors, exposures in the environment that will tend to turn on genes that can have a negative impact. And then there's positive changes. And I'll just give you an example from my own life. I remember when I was back in my 20s and I was struggling with all kinds of health issues and finally discovered the whole issue of nutrition and diet. And I looked around and I said, you know what? I really need to pay attention to this and eating right for me, because there are no old people in my family, number one. And number two, the people that are starting to get older are overweight, they're sick, they've got all kinds of diseases, and they're on medications. And that's not where I want to go. So I just made an assumption. This was long before the genomics, the genomics project was really in full swing. We didn't really know much about what those genes were. But I just assumed at that time that I had bad genes. I said, I probably have bad genes because there's no old people, and anybody that's even getting close to being old is sick and overweight. So I'm going to do the very best I can. And I cleaned up my environment. I got really pristine about what I ate. I tuned into how it was affecting me. I shifted things around a lot in terms of percentage of carbs and protein and fat until I found what really worked for me. I was able to adapt that from season to season because that makes a difference too. And I've been healthy, vibrantly healthy since then, like overwhelmingly energetic and full of mental clarity. And so I decided when it got to be affordable to be able to do your own gene testing, I did a gene test on myself, and I had already been doing them on other people. And I was shocked to find that, yeah, my genes were just as bad as these people that were crumpled up in little balls on the couch with fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. And I wasn't there. Why? Because I decided that I was going to shift that. I was going to shift the expression of those genes and make sure that the ones that were negatively affecting me were turned off. And now that I know a few things, I've adapted a few things. You know, like I have a bad vitamin A gene, or vitamin A conversion gene. So I take vitamin A. I don't just rely on beta carotene. And I take extra vitamin D because I have the vitamin D receptor gene. So there's things I've adjusted as a result. But the fact is that I know I changed the epigenetic. I know I changed the expression of those genes.
Well, that is the key point. You can switch these genes off and on, and that's what we're doing with a bad diet, is we're switching them. We're switching on all the bad genes, the ones that would cause cancer, and we're silencing the good genes that would protect us. I have the same story, a little bit different. I love that story that you just told, because, you know, people would say to me, oh, you must have good genes, because, you know, for my age, I don't have gray in my hair, and I'm slender, and my hormones work quite well, and I have lots of energy, things like that. That, you know, usually you lose all that. Live very limber, and so I thought I had great genes too. I thought, well, I guess lucky me. Then I had my genes tested, and I had all the bad genes. I mean, I should have breast cancer, diabetes, be overweight. I couldn't believe it. Vitamin D receptor, like you, comp, mal, all those ones were detox. My detox genes were awful. And I thought, thank God, you know, this path that I went on years ago, initially for myself, because I was so sick, but I like to teach, so I, you know, shared it with other people, and now that's what's become body ecology. But, you know, if I hadn't stepped on that path, I would be a mess by now.
Yeah.
So this is a really good thing to know. So that's, therefore, for many people who are out there thinking they're feeling great, the gene testing will verify that yes, you should be eating those fats. Your body needs them, and so this is just an amazing new tool that we've never had before.
Absolutely.
And also the other thing I'd like to say is that we have no more time, literally. You know, years ago, a woman named Theo Kolben wrote a book called Our Stolen Future, and what she basically said, what she noticed, was that in the animal world, female birds were nesting together, and when a bird laid an egg, the shell was all thin. And so obviously that egg would not become a little chicken or whatever, bird or whatever. And so but that's happening right now. So, you know, it takes a little longer for the human being to get to where the other animals are because we have a pretty amazing body. But here's what's happening. Right now, three women, only three women out of four cannot get pregnant naturally. They have to go to a doctor to get pregnant and do something like IVF. And then a lot of times they spend a fortune and go through this awful process of getting their hormones really jacked up, and then they lose the baby anyway. It's a horrible, horrible thing to have women doing. And then also by 2025, when I checked in to speak at the Autism One conference in May, by the, you know, they were handing out this little, some statistics, and the thing that just I never forgot after that I saw that was that at the rate we're going with the children coming in, all the autistic children, in 10 years, by 2025, every other baby will be on the spectrum, firmly on the autism spectrum. So we have no more time. Rachel Carson wrote her book, what was her book called?
The Silent Spring.
She warned us, we didn't pay attention. Then Theo Kolbrun came around and wrote Our Stolen Future. We have stolen our children and our grandchildren's future. It is really, really time to turn this around. And so now we have the tools, and you've got people like us out there passionately trying to reach you. Please take this seriously and start learning this stuff.
Yeah, and rather than thinking of your genes as a death sentence, because, you know, my mom died at age 56 of heart disease. My dad died at age 62 of heart disease. My grandmother died at 72 after quadruple bypass after having heart disease. My aunts, my uncles, I mean, I could go on and on. That would say to me, oh, my God, I'm approaching those ages. Am I going to die of heart disease? As opposed to taking control and saying, you know what, maybe that hamburger and french fries and shake are really not so appealing after all, if it's going to lead me down that path. And maybe all this wonderful fermented food and kale and other things that are healthy for me are really delicious. And they're going to get me to the path that I want to be, which is healthy and vibrant. And you're a role model, Donna. I mean, almost 70, I'm just like dying. There's no way you look like you're almost 70 or act like it. And it just is a testament to what you teach and what you do. And I just want to interject to make sure if anybody's come on late that we're speaking with Donna Gates, the author of The Body Ecology Diet, and you can reach her at bodyecology.com, and she's got a tremendous amount of resources out there. And she, long before every other brand of probiotic beverage on the shelves was out there, where you could just go to the local health food store and buy, this is what she was talking about, making your own coconut kefir and taking care of the gut bugs. And probiotics are now a household word, and I think partly because of you, because you've been speaking about it for so long, and it's nice that people are just, it's finally becoming a household word. So thank you for all that you've done.
Thank you. But there's still so much to
There's still so much
it's really
to do.
It's just like we've just, like, you know, thrown a little tiny pebble in the ocean. It's making that much of a difference of a wave. You said something that I thought was interesting, because you said you thought kale and vegetables like that were delicious, but, you know, I don't know if you tested this gene on yourself, but I have what's called a bitter taster gene, and a whole bunch of people do.
Yeah.
That means that when we have the dark green leafy vegetables, Brussels sprouts, kale, broccoli, if you have bitter tasting things like coffee, they are bitter to us. They taste very bitter, but, you know, for all the people that do not have the bitter tasting gene out there, you don't taste the Brussels sprouts and the broccoli and the coffee don't taste the same way that it does to someone with a bitter taster gene. Did you check to see if you're a bitter taster?
I did, and I am not a bitter taster, and my husband is. But the interesting thing about that is I love kale, and I can eat dandelion right out and arugula right out of the bag with nothing on it, and I love it. But I hate coffee, so I've never been able to drink coffee, and maybe it's not the bitter, maybe it's something else that my body's rejecting, because I also have that gene where I don't metabolize caffeine real well, so that might be.
I was going to mention that.
Yeah.
You know, and also, it's a big problem if you have a child and you're trying to get them to eat broccoli or kale or Brussels sprouts or something, because you know it's healthy for them, very healthy. Cruciferous vegetables are extremely healthy for clearing estrogen in the body, and just so much research on the value of them preventing breast and prostate cancer, colon cancer. But, you know, so you have this little child, and he or she's been born with a bitter taster gene. They won't like the broccoli. Well,
yes.
What you have to do is keep offering anyway. Put a little bit of butter, a little tiny pat of butter on the top, and olive oil or something, you know, fix it in a way that they will eat it. because if you give it to them, they'll grow up liking it anyway, because I love vegetables, and I've got the bitter taster gene. They're my favorite thing of all. Kale, I could eat. I have to eat almonds every day. I have to eat kale, I think. So you can change your, you can take something like that that's a bitter taster. Same thing with sugar. You know, some of us we taste sugar differently, and so some of us taste a lot of sweet. And if we eat something sweet, it's very sweet for us. Of course, if you're eating fermented vegetables, which are very sour, they make things taste very sweet too. If you eat sour, a carrot tastes very sweet to you, and a candy bar tastes disgustingly sweet.
Mm-hmm.
But there's actually a gene that tells you if you're a sweet taster. And then, of course, the problem with the sweet taster people is that they love sweets, and they have a tendency to eat a lot of them, and then they...
Yes.
Of course, it's so addictive, too. So the big question becomes, are you addicted to sugar because it's addictive, or do you have the sweet taster gene?
Yeah.
And you can tell if you, like, go off of it for 4 or 5 days and then eat sour foods like fermented foods and lemon juice and all, and then you don't... You're fine. But if you have the sweet taster gene, you might be out there thinking, oh, I would give anything for an ice cream cone right now.
Interesting. You know, it's interesting because as we're talking about this, I'm thinking about my own kids, right? My older son hates sweet stuff. He says, I must have the anti-sweet tooth because he just doesn't like sweet tooth, but he could sit down and eat bowls and bowls of broccoli and kale. So I haven't tested him, so I don't know. He probably does not have either gene, right? He probably has neither one.
He probably would prefer to have a little piece of chicken or protein or something.
Well, he doesn't eat chicken or anything, but he loves fermented foods. He'll literally take a jar of sauerkraut and walk around the house with a fork, and that's, I'm hungry, what can I eat? And he walks around the house with a jar of sauerkraut. Like, this is a kid that loves sour. Whereas my younger son, it's so hard to get him to eat vegetables, and we have to put sauces and all kinds of things on them, and he loves sweet. So I have to look back. We've done his genetics, and I haven't looked back to see, but I have a feeling that he has the bitter gene and the sweet gene, which is probably your worst combination, right?
Probably, yeah.
Okay, pour the sugar over it.
A lot of people are salt sensitive. Now, this is an interesting topic because you always read in articles that you don't have salt, and then you go, you know, the next day you read an article that says, you have to have salt for your adrenal. So who's right?
Right.
Well, number one, the salt that they're talking about is the horrible salt that's in all the processed food and all the fast food restaurants and everything you get when you're eating out, all the processed food you buy, bring into your house, it has bad salt in it. So nobody should ever eat that. But then the salt-sensitive people have to have high-quality salt, and they only need about a teaspoon max a day. Well, that's a fairly decent amount. I mean, you can make a pot of soup and put a couple of teaspoons of salt in there, but you're not going to eat that whole pot at one time.
Right.
It's really fascinating to look at the genes. The salt-sensitive people do have to be careful, particularly as they get older, if they also have the gene that indicates that they have a tendency to have high blood pressure. You know, because high blood pressure is a silent killer, they say. You don't know you have high blood pressure, and then suddenly you die.
Well,
salt-sensitive people are weakening their kidneys, which are related to weakening the, you know, having high blood pressure. So you also want to look at the genes in relationship to each other.
Right. So, you know, can you throw out some of the names of some of those genes? So people, if they may have heard some of these genes, they'll go, oh, yeah. Or if they've done their, some people have done their 23andMe test, but then it comes back and they go, oh, what does this mean?
Well, there is a ton of information available. What you want to do, let's say you've done 23andMe or another test, they usually give you the name of the gene. Like the sweet taster, it's called TAS1R3. But it has beside it a little RS number, little small R, little small S, and then the number 357-44813. So let's say that you go to the internet, PubMed or Snippedia, SNPEDIA, and you type in, you know, up in your search bar there, you type in, just cut and paste your RS number, and up will come a bunch of stuff about the sweet taster gene and all the research they've done on it. And then just, you know, hang out, like come back another month or two later and check it out again, because there'll probably be a whole lot more stuff posted up there because there's so much research going on
right.
this now. Then you begin to learn about yourself. It might be related to Parkinson's because somebody just did some studies on that, or whatever, you know, but the RS number is what you want to look up. So most people don't know that, and that's a really
good
handy
tip. And there's more and more. I mean, years ago you could not look up genes and have so much up there, but there's so much out there, so.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, most of the time it highlights the real key things that they're looking at, like this gene is related to, you're at risk for, see, that's the key term, at risk for breast cancer, prostate cancer, bone density problems.
Right.
It's only a risk factor. You control the switch.
Right.
You turn that switch on. You turn the switch off or on that turns the gene off or on by what you eat, how you think, are you getting enough sleep. It's just the most, to me, it's the most exciting thing that has come about in the last couple, you know, well, just since I've been doing this work, back in the days when everybody thought sugar was healthy for you, and it was like, I felt like I was, you know, trying to say, no, sugar's not good, gluten's not good either, and you got to eat these fermented foods. It's like, people thought I was crazy, I'm quite sure, and there were not that many people interested, but today, many people are interested.
Oh, yeah.
And so, the great thing, the really extraordinary thing is that maybe because we are so interested, and we're putting this big vibration, this big prayer or question out into the universe saying, help, help, we need some help. We have this great new understanding of the gut and the microbiome and their genes. You know, that's a hot area of research. And now we're finally, for the first time that man has ever lived upon this earth, able to look at our genes and really fine-tune our diet and adjust things to exactly what we need. And when you start to fix the genes, see, that's the key thing, too, to know, is they have an intervention. If you have a SNP or a variation, or which means the gene isn't functioning well and it's not, that's not good. You know, your gene for high blood pressure isn't functioning well and you're at risk for high blood pressure. Well, you can fix that. You know, there's ways, there's interventions or fixes for the genes. And you know, so they don't report on the genes until they know. There's solid research supporting it, that this gene really does this, and that they have an intervention. That's when people like to hear about the gene, is when they have an intervention. And then you know, the practitioner or the very educated public, because I think both of us have a very educated following.
Yes.
You know, we know a lot, and you can take what your genes are telling you, and then you have to interpret it. You know, like, for example, let's take the gluten intolerant gene. Well, there's two genes that are looked at, DQ2.5 and DQ8, that if you have those genes, then, you know, yes, you've been born with a risk for celiac disease. So let's say somebody says, oh, good, I don't have those genes. I can eat all the gluten food I want. No, there's other problems with gluten besides, you know, it's just an awful thing to put in your body and the whole story in and of itself, and
right.
You know, it's a gummy food. Like, usually you buy gluten, it comes in donuts and pastries and sandwiches and, you know, French toast and all these things, you know, bad stuff, that when you eat it, it gets into your gut and it gums it up. You know, it's just like gummy paste and going through your body, so it doesn't make it through your body, it stays stuck in there.
And so worse, it damages.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, than that, it damages the villi and the spaces between.
Absolutely. I mean, so there's a whole story around the gluten. So you can't just say, oh, I'm good to go. I don't have those two genes.
One other thing I wanted to add, you know, there are the DQ genes are pretty specific for celiac, but there are other genes too that you need to look at to say whether or not you can tolerate it. There's some HLA genes, and there's also CTLA, which is related to the thyroid. And if you have any of those and you have a tendency towards autoimmune conditions, then staying off the gluten is imperative as well. So it's not as simple and cut and dry as just this gene says I have a tendency to this disease, therefore if I don't have that tendency, I can just be reckless and carefree. That there's really a lot that people have to be keeping in mind.
So it's the HLA, so it's the DQ2.5, DQ8, HLA. Mostly when you're
and the other one is CTLA. There's a couple that are related to Hashimoto's and autoimmune, and you've got to watch for that, for the gluten, when you have a tendency towards autoimmune.
Do you know something that's really fascinating, and I really hope somebody's listening that's going to have a baby or know someone who's going to have a baby, if you have a gene that is not functioning right, and, you know, that you and your partner get pregnant and you are not expressing that gene, you will not pass that on to your baby. So this is really important. You know, you're probably real familiar with the work that they did at Duke University, where they took a, you know, these mice or mouse or this group of pregnant moms, there were mice, and they had the gene for being fat and had strange color, kind of a yellowish coat. And then they fed them a diet that was rich in folate, which fixed the gene that they were deficient in. You know, they had a problem with the folate gene, and they gave the mom rats. They gave them folate, and all the babies were born with beautiful, slender bodies. They were big and fat. The moms were big and fat, and the babies were beautiful and slender and had this beautiful brown coat. They lived a long, really long, healthy time. So, you know, we can change the expression of our genes.
Totally.
And bring into the world a much healthier generation. And we have to do that because we've been making a big mistake now for quite a few generations.
Right. And a lot of that, but for those of you who are more astute, the gene that Dawn is talking about related to folate is MTHFR. And that's been in the news a lot lately. And it's people just tend to focus on that one gene. Oh, yeah, I got to get the genetic testing done. And they'll just test that one gene and then say, as if the whole answer is just give somebody folate and their whole gene picture is going to get better. So that's why we're doing this today, is to really open up your eyes to the fact that it's more complicated than that. And it's way more in your control than that. So, and folate is a B vitamin, and when we say folate, it's very different from folic acid, and I want to make sure that that's really clear, because folic acid is the synthetic form of folate, and if you're taking a supplement that has folic acid in it, I highly recommend that you dump it in the trash, because that can interfere with the mechanisms that are related to DNA repair and methylation, meaning, you know, some of the liver pathways related to heavy metal detox. There's so many things that taking that supplement with folic acid can interfere with.
Clearing estrogen,
dopamine, especially if you have that genetic, even if you don't have it. But 45%-ish, maybe you have some more up-to-date figures than that,
yeah,
but my study is that 45% of the population has a defect in one of those. I have two of them, two different MTHFR genes that are out, and it's really important that you're getting good folate when, you know, which is comes from foliage, right? Raw, organic, green leafies, yay! And taking a methylfolate supplement versus a folic acid supplement. So thanks for bringing that part up.
I'm so glad you brought that up. That's a perfect example. I have that too. I'm red for the MTHFR 677G. So I've got it myself. And wow, what a difference it made, you know. And well, not in me, because I was already doing the right things. But it is supposed to be 40% of the population. But what I find, because you know, healthy people don't come to people like us.
Right.
People who come to us are, they've tried everything. They can't go, well, they spent a fortune, and then they come. And so in that population, I think it's like 80% at least. I see that MTHFR comp, vitamin D receptor. I see those repeatedly over and over again. Now, MAOA, that's another one. It seems so many people have those. Very important to know that about yourself.
I think it is. And, you know, just from my experience in doing a couple hundred of these tests so far, I had two people who did not have the MTHFR. Two out of all of those people that did not have one of the MTHFR genes.
I know. I'm always so surprised when I say, wow, you do not have it. It's like, lucky you.
Just
won the lottery here.
Right. Okay, so you want to talk about lactose and tolerance to milk fat and milk sugar, and because dairy is a big thing. Like, people don't want to go if they're dairy. They want their cheese. They want their butter. And yet, I mean, from my perspective, there's two reasons I like to get people off of it. One is cross-reactivity with gluten, and so many people are sensitive to gluten. 90% of people that are sensitive to gluten are also sensitive to dairy. That's the statistics I've seen. But also that lactose intolerance is very common, and physiologically, our bodies they're not supposed to be consuming milk after weaning. If you look at the way nature intended, no other species do. So the production of lactase goes down, which is the milk sugar digesting enzyme, goes down after the age of 4. So it's kind of natural, but there's some people who tolerate it well. So
yeah,
let's talk about it.
I would like to talk about this subject because I think there's a lot of confusion around this one. I, for example, am green for lactose intolerance, so I'm fine. But all my life I couldn't do dairy. I mean, even from the beginning of my life, I had trouble, you know, back in the days when I was born, moms were put to sleep and the baby came out and they handed you to your mom and they said, here, Mrs. Jones, here's your little girl or boy. And they, you were drugged, you know, the baby boomers came out drugged. And then they didn't breastfeed you for sure. Like it wasn't in.
Right.
So finding, I understand because I don't remember, but I understand they couldn't find anything to feed me in the beginning. But so I've always had it. Right, I'm sure they fed me something because I lived. But anyway, so I just assumed that food was bad for me. Dairy foods were. And I can never tolerate them. Extremely mucus forming. And I lost energy when I would eat them. And then I had my gene tested and I thought, oh, wait, I'm not lactose intolerant. And then I realized, but there's other components in the milk besides the sugar.
Yes.
And so, for example, there's fat, and I do have the genes where I can't eat the saturated fat. So, you know, for me, if you were to tell me, oh, children need a lot of fat in their milk, but some people say that, children need the high-fat milk. Well, I was an example of a little kid that did not need that fat at all. And so I would have been better on low-fat milk. And then also, what else? Casein, you know, that's another component.
Right.
A lot of people reacting to the casein. If you've got any kind of gut problems, you do not want to put casein in your gut.
Right.
So it's another component of milk. So you can't just, you got to look at the whole story. And
exactly.
Then why do so many people tolerate? Well, in countries like Russia and Poland and where else they eat? A lot of fermented milk, you know, kefir.
The kefir and yogurt and stuff. Yeah.
Yogurt and kefir. But see, that's different because the milk, what's happened is they're fermenting it. So now it's got all this good bacteria if you make it right. Like we have the starter, so you can make kefir right in your own home, and it's so live and fresh. Well, these bacteria produce lactase, so they eat up the sugar, and then there's still some in there, you know, when you're drinking the kefir, let's say. For the people who can, like all the millions of people that eat yogurt, I highly recommend you switch over to kefir. Make it at home because it's way more potent. But then realize that you may have to get your milk, take the fat out of it and, you know, make it low fat, and then you'll tolerate it better. You can't have a gut problem. So that explains why people do find, and, you know, every food has a front and a back. Muscle-wise, milk is really good for building muscles. I found a lot of elderly people, you know, try it and start to put muscle back on, and they feel so much better because it's, you know, it's pre-digested, so it's easy for them to digest. The other time, I actually find a lot of people do very well on fermented kefir is the pregnant women. When they're pregnant, when they're nursing, it seems their body seems to change to be able to take that food in, even if they couldn't before and they can't after. So you want to look at the genes because they tell you some great information. And then you have to kind of, another thing you want to do is if you have blood tests, like the gene that you mentioned, Rita Marie, about the MTHFR, that's about, you'll have a tendency for high homocysteine if you have a SNP there, variation there.
Right.
So but then you look at your blood test and you've had your homocysteine measured and it's fine. Or your B12 is fine, even though the genes say that you have trouble with absorbing B12. But your test results are saying, oh, you're fine. So what you're doing is working for you.
Exactly. I like that you brought that up. I totally
In other words, you want to look at what's working. Like look at things like other tests, verify what the genes are saying, because you may not need to need an intervention. You may be already with a folic acid. You know, you might be eating things like asparagus and dark green leafy vegetables. They have a lot of folate in them, and so you're fine, even though you have that SNP.
Right. It's just what you do as your diet and lifestyle. And I know a lot of people want to look at these gene tests and say, oh, the gene test is going to tell me what to do. No, the gene test is part of that whole picture. And you've got to start with the foundations, which you and I talk about all the time, the whole foods, fresh foods diet with good gut flora and feeding the gut flora. So
I mean, that's what you realize, that when you study the gut, what you realize is that you have to, food is the most important thing, and preparing it properly. And then you look at the genes and you realize food is the most important thing, and preparing it properly. But also other things are always important too. Are you getting sleep? Are you exercising?
Absolutely.
Do you get enough sunlight? There's a gene called the vitamin, actually there's several vitamin D genes, and one of them I find out, and I just always see people with this with a vitamin D receptor SNP, mm-hmm. meaning that they can take vitamin D as a supplement, they can get out into the sunlight. Their body may make, you know, vitamin D, but it's not getting into the cell. And that's called the VDR, vitamin D receptor SNP. So that gene is fixed by something called sulforaphane, and you get sulforaphane in cultured vegetables.
Mm.
And you can buy it as a supplement, too. You can buy sulforaphane. Broccoli seed extract is what it's also called.
Right. So if you're doing broccoli sprouts, if you're doing the broccoli seeds, you can even get broccoli seeds and grind them up and put them into your food. You can do the extract. And eating cruciferous, if you eat enough of them, sulforaphane is common in your cruciferous vegetables. Great. That's good to know.
Well, the reason I like to recommend the cultured vegetables, too,
and the cultured,
is that
right.
These foods don't have the sulfur, like the broccoli seed extract. It's not, that's considered the highest source of sulforaphane, but it's not sulforaphane yet. There are two little sacks sitting beside each other, and one of them has an enzyme called myrinase, and the other one has glucoraphanin. I always hope I pronounced that right.
I know it's a hard word.
They're sitting beside each other in these two little sacks, and if you cut them, you know, cut the vegetable or, you know, put it in your Vitamix or chop it up and pack it. Break the two sacks. They mix together, and that's where sulforaphane comes from. But when you're making fermented vegetables, the great thing about them is they always, any nutrients in them are enhanced hundreds of times. So I highly recommend, for various reasons, like I was so excited when I looked at the genes to see how many times the fermented foods positively express genes and fix genes, like the NRF2. And the NRF2, for some reason, one of my favorite, just because I think I love that little, that name.
The name of it.
NRF2.
Yeah.
Isn't it a cute name?
Very
cute. Anyway, it's considered by a lot of people to be the master anti-aging gene. It's also expressed by sulforaphane and cultured vegetables. And anyway, so Eli Mishnikov years ago said, you know, people that ate fermented foods seem to age very well.
Yeah.
He did. He aged very well. He ate fermented foods. And now we come along, long over 100 years later, and we say, oh, there's a little master anti-aging gene, NRF2, and this gene loves sulforaphane.
Mm.
It's switched on positively, and you get it from eating fermented vegetables. So he was right. But now we can say, Eli, here's why that's true.
That's awesome. I love that. So it makes me really happy about sometimes my lunch is just like a big bowl of sauerkraut with some chopped up avocado on top, and it's like, ah, it's heavenly.
And I've had many people tell me that they can't digest eggs at all unless they have some fermented vegetables with the eggs to help them digest it. Of course, the latest thing I've been, I was speaking at a fermentation festival, and somebody, well, I don't know who she was. I'd gotten her name, but she's an expert up in Santa Barbara, and she works with a bunch of doctors. And they did a study on people with gut problems, and they found that if people ate commercial eggs, they didn't digest them. Nobody did. But if they started eating organic eggs, 40% of the people still had trouble digesting those eggs. But when they gave them fertile eggs, then they all digested them. So I've now started telling people that it looks like it's a good idea to eat fertile eggs. They're easier to digest. But then putting a few spoonfuls of cultured vegetables in the plate and some asparagus or broccoli or something, that's a perfect brunch, you know, a perfect morning meal around 11 o'clock in the morning if you're at home. It would be great.
Do you, going back to the cultured vegetables, do you think that it's because, do the cultured vegetables also help break down and metabolize sulfur? Because some people have the genes that they don't metabolize sulfur real well. And so when they try to eat these foods that are supposed to be really good for them, like the cruciferous and garlic and onions and such, they don't do well because their body doesn't metabolize the sulfur. So I want to get, you know, from your experience, does it help with that?
The NAT genes are, you know, about
yeah, the NATs and the CBS and those sorts.
Yeah, CBS, uh-huh. Well, you know, the funniest thing, I'm not sure I can 100% answer that question from a scientific point of view, but I can certainly tell you that the coconut water kefir that I, you know, created years ago and started having mothers with their children had autism and we're helping them recover. And the fermented coconut water is a big important part of fixing the gut and beginning the journey to recovery, which many of them have recovered. Anyway, there's sulfur in that, and then the coconut water that's fermented, and they just thrived on it. Then also, if you're worried, I wouldn't maybe put garlic, maybe onions in my fermented vegetables, but it doesn't match. Like, in other words, there must be something happening during the fermentation process that makes that go away. And I know I've had, you know, other health people have contacted me and said, so-and-so said, don't eat fermented foods because whatever. And yet we find people thrive on them and they're not having a problem with them. So absolutely. I don't quite know. That's one of those big question marks that I have out there yet still. And I haven't quite figured out what that answer is yet.
Well, there's so much to learn, and I think it goes back to really us individualizing our diet for ourselves and really learning these things and using these various inputs to then help us to customize a diet, because whereas one person might thrive on a raw vegan diet, another person doesn't for whatever reasons and thrives on a macrobiotic diet or a paleo diet, mm-hmm. or I like to call it if somebody's sitting in front of me and their name is Sue, I'll say it, we're going to create the Sue diet. Can we do that? Do you know about the Sue diet?
Yeah.
And they'll go, what?
Yeah.
The Sue diet? You mean like Sue Indians? I'm like, no, the Sue diet. The diet that's right for Sue, for you. Right, and it might be slightly different proportionally, and the way we know it is to have a sense of what some of these gene things are. Look at our gut and the way our gut is behaving, and were we breastfed or not, and were we on antibiotics or not, and then tailor it to what feels good. Because you don't know how many
conditions in your body too,
and the conditions.
Like,
yeah,
that you have candidiasis, then you are going to move more toward. You're going to be more what would be called paleo, but if you stay on that diet and you're not sleeping and feeling kind of depressed and everything, you're not getting enough serotonin, so you really do need to, we have that all worked out in body ecology. We have people eating the grain like seeds, like quinoa and millet, so they get the B vitamins and fiber for the gut. And, you know, because the paleo people would have you believe that those foods are evil.
Right.
And they may be very, very important for you so that you're calmer, so that you sleep better, so you have fiber in your gut.
Yep. And some people, I don't know if you can address this or not, but I hear people that they'll go and start to increase the fiber in their diet, eat more vegetables, make smoothies, eat more salads, and then they get constipated. You have anything to say about that?
Actually, that leads into one thing I really wanted to cover. Hopefully we have enough time still, but, you know, the bacteria in your gut have a lot to do. There's a lot of things happening when constipation is going on, more than just the fiber. Are you getting enough exercise and walking, for example, so you move? But one of the things that's important to know is that bifidus bacteria is an important bacteria for people going to the bathroom well, eliminating well. And there's a gene. I love to teach people about this gene because it's a life changer gene. It's called the FUT2 gene. And it's a gene that, first of all, you don't absorb B12, so taking methyl B12 is a smart thing to do. But the other thing about the people with the FUT2 gene is that they are called non-secretors. Peter Giordano talked about this years ago, but it didn't stick. People didn't understand how important it was. But now we're seeing a lot of people with FUT2, with the FUT2 SNP. And what that means is that you, we all have a blood type, like I'm an A. What's your blood type?
I'm a B minus.
You're B? And then, you know, so B, O, A, A, B. You might, if your husband's an O, you might have some AB children. Mm-hmm. But we all have our unique blood type. Whatever our blood type is, we secrete, the blood has sugars in it, sugar molecules, and we secrete those sugar molecules into our certain places in our body, into our tears, into our saliva, into our sweat, and into our gut lining. And if you're not secreting like you're a non-secretor, which is what the food to gene SNP person is. They're a non-secretor. So they're not secreting their sugar molecules into their gut, for example. So they're not going to be able to feed the bifidus bacteria that live there. That's a big, big deal. Imagine a child from the very beginning of their life, when bifidus is the most important bacteria in the gut for a long time, they don't get started off with the right bacteria in their gut because they're not secreting their sugar molecules. Same thing with a woman who's breastfeeding and she's a food to non-secretor. She's not secreting sugar molecules into her breast milk either. So the baby's, you know, her baby, that baby's going to start life without this really important bifidus bacteria. So they're maybe constipated all their life. So I've had people get, like, Flora Babies, a product that Renew Life makes that they can just buy and then put it in their water and drink it all day long, or, you know, find times throughout the day to take a spoonful of it. And people have said to me, wow, what a difference that makes. I've had just got a picture from a mom, but picture of her little girl who was always having health problems, and now all she did was add the bifidus bacteria, and now to every, you know, she's eating healthy too, but that was the key for her. And so when if you've got, this is a perfect example of how a SNP can be fixed, and it's a huge difference in your life. Wow. So that's the food too, Jean. You want to test that one for sure.
Wow, that's so good. I didn't know about that. So you're saying that the secretors will secrete these
sugar molecules. Blood. Like, in other words, you're a bee, so you're secreting bee sugar molecules. I'm secreting A sugar molecules into my mouth, tears, saliva, sweat. But also think about your saliva. So if you're a non-secretor and you're not secreting the food, your sugar molecules into your mouth to feed the bacteria there, you're going to have more mouth disease type problems.
Interesting. So they're not getting the good stuff that they're supposed to be getting to feed them and have them thrive.
If you don't have the money to do a gene testing, you now save up for it, because it's important to do. But if you can't, you know, just do something like take the Flora Baby anyway. It's a very bifidus bacteria.
It's a bifidus. Really, it's a bifidus. It has high amounts of bifidus. Yeah, and it's interesting.
You notice, gosh, I'm eliminating better.
Yeah.
I'm quieter.
Well, that's good to know.
Then you think, oh, I might be a not food too secretor, and you can verify that later on with a gene test.
Oh, wow, that's great. I learned something there. Very well. Thank you. Oftentimes when I do stool tests on people and it tells what the gut flora looks like, I see a lot of adults that are low in bifidus. So that's a place to look. Awesome.
That's probably why, because remember, we see people that tend to have health issues, gut problems,
exactly.
And so on.
Exactly. Cool. Cool. You mentioned a couple of times about the fat and the low-fat diet, high-fat diet. Which of the genes is related to that?
Well, there's the ApoE gene, which is, if you are an ApoE 3, 4, or 4-4, you've got to be on a low saturated, you've got to watch saturated fats in your diet from animal foods. These people can do fine on saturated fat from coconut oil and medium chain triglyceride, like brain octane. They're fine with that. The ApoE 4 and 3-4 and 4-4, they should be definitely more vegetarian. This is the gene that people are concerned about because it can put you at risk for Alzheimer's. So they need a very high plant-based diet. Maybe 10% of their diet can be animal food and 10-20% max animal protein, but get rid of the saturated fat. And they don't even do well on the monounsaturated fats. Like, they can't take much of that. You know, everybody says, oh, olive oil. Everybody can take olive oil. Well, this gene, people with this gene can't. Then there's the ApoA2, and it's an interesting gene because it has two different SNPs. Like, it can be a variant in two different ways. Now, if a person with the ApoA2C variant, so it goes off in that direction, changes to a C, what that means is that if you eat saturated fats like butter, cream, lard, and so on, and with that variant, eating saturated fats will make you fat. But if you have a variant that's called the ApoA2T variant, so if it goes in that direction, you can eat the saturated fat and it won't make you fat. So I was like, how could I remember that? I thought, oh my gosh. So I just remembered C is chubby. If you eat the fat, you get chubby. And T is trim.
I like
your ApoA2T variant and eat some saturated fat. No, nobody should. I mean, there's other things to look at too, like how does your liver handle the fat?
Exactly.
You can't have a lot of fat if your liver's all congested either. So it's not just the genes we want to look at here. And by the way, you can test a bunch of liver genes, like all the CYP450s are all about the liver, what's happening there, and how does the liver clear the toxins when they come into the body. Then another one is the, there's one called the adipoQ gene, which is about adiponectin. Now, adiponectin is a hormone that helps maintain insulin sensitivity. And again, if you eat a high-fat diet, that means that it lowers your adiponectin levels. You don't have enough adiponectin. And that means you're not going to burn as much fat. So those people are at a greater chance of being overweight, even obese, and have type 2 diabetes. So there's also, you want adiponectin. It's very important. It helps keep inflammation down in the body. If you have high adiponectin levels, you have much less chance of becoming a diabetic. And that gene, anyone that has that gene, does better on a low-fat, a low-carb diet. They don't want to have a lot of sugar in their diet. That sugar also lowers adiponectin. And then they can't be in a high-fat diet with a lot of saturated fat. So this particular group of people does really well with the monounsaturated fats like olive oil. You know, everybody looks like they do well on omega-3s. Even the ApoE 3 and 4, they need that fish oil. So the intervention, you have the adipoQ variation. What you want to have is a low-carb diet because sugar also lowers your adiponectin levels. Which is why, again, high sugar diet, you're going to go toward being an insulin resistant, becoming diabetic. These people with the adipoQ gene, they want to be on a, they can't have saturated fat. They just have to avoid it. And, of course, avoid the trans fats that are out there in the world, the refined canola oil and all that.
That's everybody.
They have to be out of the diet. Yeah. That's lowering adiponectin. You can have your monounsaturated fats. That's great. And also omega-3 is very important. And that's one thing I will say I've noticed consistently over and over again is that every single one of these genes seems to need the omega-3s like krill and fish and algae. Those are all good.
Yeah.
So chia seeds and anywhere where you can get more omega-3 in your diet, the genes seem to really like that.
Okay.
Then, interestingly, for people on this with this particular SNP, they do well on calorie restriction. So they have to be careful not to overeat.
Mm-hmm. And when you say calorie restriction, do you think like intermittent fasting is something?
No, just like, you know, like don't overeat at a meal. And I always think the body ecology diet is a form of calorie restriction because we have very simple meals. And we've combined the food in such a way that you might have a piece of protein and a vegetable and fermented vegetables. And then at night you would have, did you want to make more serotonin, maybe millet or quinoa with some vegetables or a nice stew with a lot of vegetables and things like that in it. You're eating smaller, we have another rule called the 80-20 rule where you just keep room at the top of your stomach. You know,
I love that.
About 80% you want to fill up your stomach and then leave room at the top of your stomach. And if you eat that way, you're properly combining, using fermented foods, you're actually really following a form of calorie restriction.
I love that. Well, I want to just clarify one thing and then I want to move on to our last thing I want to talk about. But the one thing I want to clarify now with this, avoid the saturated fats. Is that also avoiding the coconut oil and that kind of saturated fat, or is it just the...
No, from animals.
The animals.
We clarified that. So if it's saturated fat from, say, coconut oil, medium-chain triglyceride fat, those seem to be just fine.
Great.
It's the animal fat, animal fat.
Okay. I love that we're talking about this because there's a lot of... everybody has to go low-fat stuff out there, and it's in the heart disease community, and I totally admire the fact that they're getting great results. But I think we see people who don't do well on complete and don't have to go that restricted. Maybe they would do well, okay. But not everybody, you know, going down to 10% fat and avoiding nuts and avoiding coconut and avocado, you know, for certain people, maybe that's necessary, but I think that a lot of the research that's been done, the kinds of fats that we're looking at are all the animal fats and the hydrogenated fats and the margarines. And so it's like people have gotten scared away from fats, and then they're going more towards like refined carbohydrates, which actually makes for bad lipid profiles anyway. So I like that we're talking about this, that there's a genetic component that, yeah, you may have to be one of those super low fat people, but look at the genes. And if you don't have to be, then you can make the diet much easier to follow and provide a lot more nutrition by having the right kinds of fats for your genetic type.
Well, people have told me that when they make these changes, they're huge for them. They may take a little while, you know, like adding the methyl B vitamins. For some people, is literally that day they feel different.
Yeah.
So it's a very important thing to do. We're fortunate finally now that we have this new information.
Mm-hmm. I think it just adds to the puzzle. It's just not about, you know, put everybody on a low-fat diet or put everybody on a vegan diet or paleo saying that all that low-fat stuff is crap. Those studies are flawed. But on the other hand, there's no studies to support, you know, eating butter all day long is really advantageous. So it's just another bit of information that we add to the pool. Like, but let's look at your genes and what are your genes allowing for?
Well, I think, too, a lot of people are spending a fortune on supplements.
Oh, I know.
They don't need, they're not beneficial, yet some of them, like you might have the CoQ2, you know, a SNP there with a CoQ10, which, you know, is a pretty expensive supplement, but what if you don't need it?
Right.
Or it's highly beneficial for you, then yes, spend the money on that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I love it. So we've done a lot, and we're running out of time, but I did want us to cover one last thing about caffeine, because that's a biggie, and again, it's a lot of controversy. Caffeine is good, it has all this stuff. Caffeine is bad, it wipes out your adrenals and messes up your gut. So how do we know whether we should be having caffeine or not, and how much of it, and is it ever good for people in terms of what's going on in their gut?
Well, interestingly, there is a ton of studies on this, and the CYP, the liver enzyme that I was mentioning, the CYP P450 enzyme, is one of them. The CYP1A2 tells you if you clear caffeine or not. So I've happened to be a slow metabolizer, and I think you said you were too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that means that if I have caffeine, it really wires me. So let's say I ate a lot of it, like a whole chocolate bar. I would be so wired, my brain wouldn't, I couldn't even function. It would just be too jumpy all over the place kind of brain. But, you know, I have a little bit early in the morning or half a cup of coffee early in the morning. And as long as it's early in the morning, I'm going to clear it by bedtime. But, you know, someone like me would, let's say, have a little cappuccino at dinner. You can be up all night long. So it's important to know this gene's a good one to know. Also, there's so much research that says, oh, a little bit of chocolate is good for you, or a little coffee. Actually, yeah, I think all those studies need to be redone, because they need to take all the CYP1A2 people out and check. And then I think you'll find that small amounts are highly beneficial for these, for everybody else, because, like, the you know, there's a lot of research that shows that people that drink a little coffee actually do live longer. So that's where things are going to change, probably. I mean, honestly, you have a very good argument here that every single study ever done has to probably be redone.
I think so, too.
That's an awful thought. I'm sure no scientist in the world would want ever to think about that.
Oh, I know. But, you know, a lot of them are deliberately done poorly, right, just so that they get the end result that they want to get. But there are a lot of good studies that are being quoted, you know, that show, oh, yeah, high-fat diet is what's really bad for insulin resistance, and you can eat all the carbs you want. Well, those studies are flawed in that the fats they're using are not healthy fats. And so they're not looking at people eating whole, fresh, organic avocados, you know, sprouted or fermented nuts or seeds made into milks and kefirs. And there's so many ways that you can do it in different ways. But, of course, the studies don't do that, because that's not the average food that's available.
Yeah, who knows how people are doing, how they're eating during that study. I'm not a big fan. I like to read studies. You have to read studies and report on them, I think, for people. But you really have to take them, with
you have to know how to read them.
And you know, the thing too, like with that chocolate, well, what comes in that bar? It could be a lot of sugar, even if it's cane sugar, it's sugar. That's going to up your dopamine levels and make you wired for a while. Then you're going to crash and want some more. So that's really addictive. So if caffeine is an addictive substance, I would take it off. But if somebody's got to have a little bit to get up going, I mean, I personally would not, you know, I don't need coffee. I love chocolate, but I don't need it. Because I don't want to be up and down, wired. Yeah. I need to be stable.
You want to be steady. Exactly.
My work done. And so for me, it's a no-no. But, you know, I don't ever tell, I've never for years said to people, give up your morning cup of coffee, because I know, I just intuitively in the beginning, I didn't feel I should and could do that. And now I know with all the research that it could be very beneficial for them. But now I would love to know what their 1A2, is saying. And then I would say, hey, I would be cautious because you've got this tendency toward high blood pressure, and you also have this salt-sensitive gene up there, which I do. I have all those. And, you know, just be careful. I just want people to know, here's what your genes are telling you. Then you make that decision.
And they make the decision, and they know, and they can use that as part of the, rather than reading every book that comes out and deciding every new diet and finding out it doesn't quite work for them. The other thing about the CYP, and it's SIP, John is saying SIP, for those of you, if you're familiar with the genes, it's CYP, CYP, like 1A2, and if you've got your thing, to look it up, because they may be looking for SIP and then going, oh, where's that?
It stands for cytochrome
P450,
but everybody shortens it to SIP, CYP.
CYP, just to clarify. But there also is an upregulation of CYP1A2 that, and you have to look at that. Some people are rapid caffeine clearers. And I know people can drink two or three cups of coffee and then sleep like a baby. And some people have a paradoxical response where they take coffee to put them out. And that's, you know, yet another thing to explore, exactly what genes are doing that. So we're all a little bit different.
It's like a baby feel just in its infancy. But we know enough now. And the other thing I would like to say to people is, because this always happens to me when I'm ready to study a new field like hormones. Just, you know, in the beginning, you're overwhelmed. There's new language that you don't know what the words mean. And so just start in little baby steps, learning something, little pieces of it, and someday you'll look back in 2 or 3, 4 months, 6 months, a year from now, and you'll think, wow, I know a lot about this, and I'm glad I do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's awesome. And I love how much we've covered so much in this talk, and the FUT genes and the MTHFRs, and it's awesome. It's awesome. And I was noticing, isn't the FUT gene, you mentioned that about the non-secretors, and this might be an important thing for people to know, especially in, you know, in reducing their risk of getting a disease that's really hard to overcome, which is Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis.
Mm-hmm. That, vitamin D receptor SNP is very much connected to Crohn's and colitis. So there's certain genes that are especially important to look at for the gut, the vitamin D receptor, FUT2, the MTHFR that you brought up, the celiac genes, and so on. Those are all important. The APOA4 is a gene that works primarily in the intestine, and the function of that gene is to carry fats into the intestine. So what if it doesn't work very well? So there's quite a lot of, the genes are playing a very important role in the gut too. The SIP, cytochrome P450E21 is about alcohol, and if you've got a SNP there, you're going to harm your gut that more so. I mean, alcohol, a little bit of wine helps the bifidus bacteria grow, but we're talking about a little bit, like a quarter of a cup, or, you know, very small amount. But if you're drinking alcohol all the time, you're screwing up your gut. But there's a gene called the CYP21 that makes you more sensitive to alcohol.
Well, thank you so much for all of this. It's been wonderful, very eye-opening. I'm sure people are sitting there going, I need to play this again. Yes, play it again, play it again.
Spread the word, because this is new information. It's like the very beginning of something we all need to know.
Right.
I think these are the kind of programs, and you have to listen to this. There's way too much information on here to hear it one time only.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I want you to just share with people how they can get a hold of you, tell them about the summit, tell them about your site, and, you know, just tell them a little bit about how they can get more of you, Donna, because I know they want more.
Well, we're bodyecology.com. It's easy to find us on the web, and we are doing a Healthy Gut Summit from February 9th to the 16th. The Gut Summit is amazing. If I could just get this list of people to talk about the gut, so I put this really big list together thinking that I'll be lucky if 5 people say yes, and everybody said yes. So it's an amazing group of speakers, and of course you are on there too. So Dr. Rita Marie Lascalzo was one of the guest speakers, and she's a special gift or bonus for people that actually purchase the summit. Right now, before it starts, it's $47, but it's the most amazing bargain in the whole world for 70-something. And so it's there. It will be there while the summit's going on. It will be there after the summit. It's like taking a really, master course in the gut.
Yeah, awesome.
We talk about biofilms and parasites. Great, great talks on parasites. You know, nobody's talking about parasites anymore, but they're really important. And, of course, gluten is, Tom O'Brien talks about gluten, but, oh, gosh, you know, Jeffrey Smith talks about GMOs, but all these other people, did I mention biofilms? And
yep.
It's just such amazing, so many aspects of what's happening in the gut is going on. So I hope Dr. Skarazian talks about the gut-brain connection. Martha Herbert's with Harvard, and she's a, brilliant brain expert herself. But, they both talked about the gut-brain connection, but everybody brings their own perspective yep. and knowledge into the picture.
Right. And what's great about it is you can listen and see what resonates for you and what really takeaways that you can have. And we have the link to the Gut Summit is on the page where you're listening to this.
iTunes. You can go every day and
yep.
listen to anyone you want, and they're for free. And then at a certain point, we hope people will purchase it because you honestly will want to keep this information and you want to listen to it more than once.
Oh, absolutely. And there's no way you can fit it all in and do it in your busy schedule. Plus, are there transcripts associated with it as well?
Oh, yeah, you get transcripts.
Yeah, so you get to read it and review it whenever, highlight it and pull out the takeaway. So I buy every summit that I really find interesting, I just buy it because I don't, I just have to go back to it and have it added to my library. So, thank you so much, Donna. It's been a joy, a pleasure to have you here. And thank you, everybody, for coming back and listening to another episode, a special episode of the Vibrant Health Solutions. Go and subscribe to us on iTunes so that you don't miss a single episode. If you're listening from iTunes, then come to drritamarieradio.com and look for this episode, and you'll be able to just click on any of the links that we talked about here. And I just go out and just every day make choices that take you closer to the health and the life that you choose and that you want. And every day we have that opportunity to live in harmony with our genes, to feed our gut bugs that are good for us and get rid of the ones that aren't. And all of those choices bring you closer and closer to living a vibrant life and a life that's filled with joy and contributing to joy on the planet. So thank you, Donna, for being here and for sharing your wisdom and your beauty. And we so appreciate you. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Rita Marie. I appreciate you very much. To me, you're brilliant. I always learn things from you. And this is a gift that you give people like me a chance to get this message out.
Thank you. This has been a most amazing interview with Donna Gates of the Body Ecology Diet and the founder of the Healthy Gut Summit, healthygutsummit.com. And I'm Dr. Rita Marie Lascalzo, and I appreciate you and your attention to your health and your dedication to making yourself as healthy as possible. Visit me at www.drritamarie.com. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, the Vibrant Health Solutions podcast, and check out my cutting-edge trainings for health coaches and health practitioners at the Institute of NutritionalEndocrinology.com, instituteofnutritionalendocrinology.com, and download a free success package for health coaches.